When Albrecht Dürer first encountered Aztec treasures sent to Europe in 1520, he marveled at the wonderful works of art and subtle intellects of men in foreign parts. This German Renaissance master wasn't alone in his astonishment. For centuries, the Aztec civilization has captivated our imagination, though often through a distorted lens focused primarily on human sacrifice and violent conquest. Camilla Townsend's fifth son shatters these misconceptions by revealing the Aztecs as they understood themselves, a people who believed they lived under the fifth sun, brought forth when an ordinary man named Nanahuatzin humbly sacrificed himself by jumping into flames to create dawn and save life on Earth. This groundbreaking work has earned recognition as one of Barack Obama's favorite books and transformed how historians approach Indigenous American history, using authentic Nahuatl texts to reveal the complex, human story of a civilization that saw themselves not as bloodthirsty warriors, but as humble people making the best of difficult circumstances with remarkable courage and ingenuity. The story of the Aztecs begins thousands of years before their empire emerged, during the last ice age, when humans first crossed from northeastern Asia into Alaska around 13,000 years ago. These early migrants gradually populated two continents, following game animals southward or traveling by canoe along coastlines. When the ice age ended about 11,000 years ago, the land bridge disappeared. Climates warmed, and people everywhere began experimenting with plants for sustenance. This transition to agriculture marked a crucial divergence between Old and New World development. While wheat and peas in the Fertile Crescent provided sufficient protein for full-time farming societies to emerge around 10,000 years ago, the Americas faced a significant delay. Native plants like teosinte, corn's ancestor, required millennia of selective cultivation to become nutritious enough to sustain populations. This agricultural gap would ultimately have profound consequences for Shieldflower's descendants when Europeans arrived with their more developed technologies. When the corn and beans agricultural complex finally emerged in Mesoamerica, it enabled remarkable civilizations to develop. The Olmec, with their mammoth stone sculptures and early writing systems, spread their influence eastward and westward. To the east, Maya artisans constructed painted pyramids rising above jungle canopies, carved elaborate writings on stone slabs, and created poetic inscriptions connecting earthly princes to creator gods. Despite their philosophical sophistication, Maya kingdoms remained practical in their pursuit of resources, waging brutal wars when necessary. To the west, other Olmec-influenced cultures flourished, including Monte Albán near Oaxaca with its representative central government, and Cuicuilco in central Mexico. When Mount Citla's eruption buried Cuicuilco in the 1st century CE, it created a power vacuum in a region where corn cultivation had enabled impressive population growth. Into this vacuum rose the mighty city of Teotihuacan, the place of people who become gods or the place of those who had great gods, which would dominate central Mexico for centuries and leave an indelible mark on the imagination of future peoples, including the Aztecs. Between the 200s and 600 CE, Teotihuacan evolved into a magnificent metropolis spanning 20 square miles and housing 50,000 people. The city featured intricately planned neighborhoods with distinct quarters for craftsmen producing obsidian tools, pottery, and textiles, alongside enclaves housing merchants from as far as Guatemala and the Gulf Coast. The city's economic reach was vast, controlling valuable resources like obsidian mines in Pachuca and establishing sophisticated trade networks that extended from the highlands of central Mexico to the tropical lowlands of the Maya region. Its cultural and political influence was so profound that Maya kings would journey over 600 miles to receive legitimacy from Teotihuacan's rulers. However, around 650 CE, a devastating crisis erupted when the working classes, likely a combination of oppressed farmers, artisans, and enslaved peoples, staged a massive uprising. The revolt specifically targeted symbols of elite power, with protesters systematically burning palaces, temples, and ceremonial precincts while deliberately sparing common residential areas. Archaeological evidence reveals careful selection in the destruction, suggesting a highly organized resistance movement rather than random violence. This collapse, coinciding with evidence of a severe drought lasting several decades, created a power vacuum that drew nomadic peoples southward from the arid regions of northern Mexico. These migrants brought with them a revolutionary military technology, the composite bow and arrow. Unlike the traditional atlatl, which required open terrain and considerable strength to operate, the bow offered superior accuracy, faster firing rates, and the ability to attack from concealment. These advantages transformed warfare in Mesoamerica. The nomadic warriors, typically young men traveling in small mobile bands, could rapidly strike agricultural settlements and retreat before organized resistance could form. Their most renowned leader was Xolotl, whose deceptively humble nickname, Little Servant Boy, masked his tactical brilliance and ruthless efficiency, earning him comparisons to Genghis Khan. Yet the story of these nomadic barbarians follows a familiar historical pattern. Despite their military superiority, they gradually absorbed the sophisticated cultural practices of central Mexico. Within generations, these former raiders had settled into agricultural communities, adopting corn cultivation and embracing the complex Mexican calendar system. This remarkable timekeeping method integrated two distinct cycles, a 365-day solar calendar tracking agricultural seasons and a 260-day ceremonial calendar used for divination and ritual. The two calendars would perfectly align every 52 years, marking significant ceremonial occasions. The architectural legacy of this period proved particularly enduring, centered on the concept of the central plaza, or town square. These spaces were framed by massive pyramidal structures, often oriented to astronomical alignments, and featured specialized ball courts. The Mesoamerican ball game was more than mere sport. It was a ritual performance combining athletic skill with religious significance. Players, using only their hips and knees, had to keep a solid rubber ball in play while attempting to score by either grounding it in the opponent's territory or threading it through elevated stone rings, a feat so difficult it often carried religious significance. This architectural template of pyramid, plaza, ball court became the standard urban planning model throughout Mexico and gradually spread northward, becoming one of the most recognizable features of Mesoamerican civilization. The people who would later be known as the Aztecs, more properly called the Mexica, proudly identified with their Chichimec barbarian ancestry, embracing their reputation as fierce nomadic warriors from the north. Their origin histories tell varied but revealing stories, most claiming to come from Chicomostoc, the place of the Seven Caves, with some specifically mentioning Aztlan, possibly place of the White Heron. These origin stories weren't merely geographic markers, but powerful symbolic narratives that legitimized their eventual rise to power. The Nahuatl language belongs to the Uto-Aztecan family, stretching from Utah to central Mexico, suggesting ancient connections across this vast region and hinting at a complex migration pattern that spanned generations. The Chichimec migrants built their power in central Mexico through strategic alliances and careful political maneuvering. Their histories frequently mention a crisis at Tula, which, though based on a real city that rose after Teotihuacan's fall, became a symbolic reference to any nomadic group's first difficult settlement among locals. This narrative pattern appeared in multiple Mexica accounts, describing periods of servitude, conflict, and eventual triumph. The core message of these histories was survival. The Mexica learned that their people deserved to live because they fought cleverly and fiercely for their freedom, often against overwhelming odds and hostile neighboring groups. When the Mexica finally settled on a marshy island others had rejected in Lake Texcoco, they adapted brilliantly to their challenging environment. They constructed sophisticated chinampas, floating gardens, by layering mud, vegetation, and soil to create fertile agricultural plots. They developed specialized fishing techniques using nets and traps and established a diverse diet, including waterfowl, fish, birds' eggs, edible insects, and nutritious blue-green algae, spirulina. Their aquatic world profoundly influenced their art and culture, with paintings and sculptures featuring crayfish, spiral shells, and water motifs. while their music incorporated themes of water and birds through both instruments and compositions. Despite challenging conditions requiring constant rebuilding of adobe structures in the wet environment, they became expert engineers, constructing elaborate dikes to control flooding, raised causeways connecting to the mainland, and an intricate network of canals for transportation and water management. Society organized into neighborhoods based on extended kin groups, kalpoli, which formed the basic social and economic units of the city. Noble families, Pipiltin, managed these districts, organizing labor for public works and recruiting warriors for military campaigns in support of the chief. Commoners, Masahualtin, maintained their own distinct identity and rights within the social hierarchy, participating in both economic and religious life. The Mexica reinforced their growing identity by adding gravel and earth to their original shrine, where, according to legend, an eagle perched on a cactus with a snake in its beak had indicated their promised homeland. This became the foundation for a large pyramid that would eventually form the heart of their sacred precinct. Priests maintained the temple complex and created detailed painted historical records on animal skins and bark paper, documenting genealogies, tribute payments, and significant events. These records were particularly important for marking the end of 52-year cycles with ceremonial bundling of years, a ritual that combined religious observation with historical record-keeping.
Itzcoatl was never intended to govern. Though his father, Acumapichtli, had been chief of the Mexica for decades, Itzcoatl was merely the son of a palace woman far from royal status. His mother had been a slave from Azcapotzalco, possibly a beautiful woman who sold vegetables in the great marketplace before being gambled away or given as a gift to the king. Though born to a slave, Itzcoatl was never enslaved himself, as Mesoamerican custom dictated that children of enslaved women were free, a practice that distinguished their society from many others of the time and allowed for social mobility even among those of humble birth. When political crisis struck in 1426 after the death of Tepanec King Tezozamoc of Azcapotzalco, a succession dispute erupted that would reshape the Valley of Mexico. Tezozamoc's son Moxtla, known for his ruthless ambition, rose against his presumed heir half-brother, brutally killed him, and then treacherously murdered Tenochtitlan's chief Chimalpopoca in his sleep. This threw Tenochtitlan into chaos, with borders to Azcapotzalco closed and trade routes disrupted, threatening the city's food supply and economic stability. Itzcoatl, at least 40 years old, and a seasoned war leader who had earned respect through numerous military campaigns, seized power next despite other available heirs from more noble lineages. Though born to a slave girl, Itzcoatl possessed not only charisma and ambition, but also strategic brilliance that would prove crucial in the coming conflicts. Rather than begging Moxtla for mercy, as some conservative counselors advised, Itzcoatl formulated a bold plan to exploit the very polygynous system that had created the crisis. He proposed a triple alliance between the Mexica, the Texcocans loyal to the exiled prince Nezahualcoyotl, and the people of Tlacopan against Moxtla. This alliance combined the military might of the Mexica, the cultural prestige of Texcoco, and the strategic location of Tlacopan. Their brutal campaign succeeded within a year, featuring innovative military tactics, including amphibious assaults across Lake Texcoco, and the first major use of the chinampas, floating gardens, as military platforms. Itzcoatl declared himself Tlatoani of the Mexica and installed Nezahualcoyotl as Tlatoani of Texcoco, creating a power structure that would dominate central Mexico for the next century. Though not formally institutionalized, the kings of Tenochtitlan, Mexica, Texcoco, and Tlacopan now ruled the valley as a de facto triumvirate, each bringing unique strengths to the alliance. They divided tribute payments proportionally, with the Mexica receiving 2/5, Texcoco 2/5, and Tlacopan 1/5 of all tribute collected. Unlike Rome's centralized imperial system, they maintained local governance structures, allowing each altepetl, city-state, to choose its own Tlatoani and govern internal affairs. This sophisticated political arrangement extended even to conquered non-Nahua communities, who retained significant autonomy as long as they provided military support for imperial campaigns, participated in public works projects like temple construction and road maintenance, and paid their tribute on time. This flexible system of indirect rule would prove remarkably stable and allow for rapid imperial expansion while minimizing the costs of administration and rebellion. Contrary to popular misconceptions, Aztec sacrifice was a solemn, quiet ceremony rather than a frenzied spectacle. Observers fasted and held sacred flowers. In early Tenochtitlan, only a few people were sacrificed during monthly festivals. Most victims were male prisoners of war, though some were young women. Victims were treated as sacred before death, and their remains were kept by their captors in places of honor. Some faced death stoically, while others wept. The Mexica believed they owed everything to their gods and that sacrifice was necessary to prevent the world's end. The Mexica, like all Nahuas, were polytheistic. Each Altepetl had carried sacred bundles devoted to their patron deity during their migrations. For the Mexica, it was Huitzilopochtli. Other important gods included Tlaloc, rain, Quetzalcoatl, wind, Tezcatlipoca, conflict, and Cihuacatl, midwifery. As the Mexica rose to power, they increasingly sacrificed prisoners rather than their own people. Whether their leaders truly believed sacrifice was cosmically necessary or used it as political intimidation remains unclear, but they lived in a dangerous world where showing weakness could mean becoming victims themselves. Mexica mothers deeply valued their children, calling them precious like polished gems or feathers. They taught their children that life was precarious. On Earth, we travel along a mountain peak. Over here is an abyss, over there is an abyss. While noble Pipiltin men might have multiple wives, the majority of people were Musahualten, commoners, who lived in monogamous marriages. Women maintained their own hearths in adobe apartments around common courtyards. In a world without modern conveniences, women's domestic work was essential and respected, with gender roles seen as complementary rather than hierarchical. For the Mexica system to work long-term, leaders had to choose military targets carefully based on rational calculations. They avoided unwinnable wars against formidable enemies like Tlaxcala, a wealthy Nahua city-state in a defensible valley. Rather than waste resources trying to conquer Tlaxcala, they established flower wars, ceremonial conflicts that maintained warrior readiness while explaining why Tlaxcala remained independent. This clever strategy would later prove costly when new enemies arrived and found ready-made allies. When Hernan Cortes arrived on the Mexican coast in 1519, the Mexica Empire was at its height under Moctezuma II. Contrary to popular myth, the Mexica didn't believe the Spaniards were gods or that Cortes was the returning deity Quetzalcoatl. Rather, they recognized the technological threat these strangers posed while attempting to manage them through diplomatic means. Moctezuma, fearing confrontation near his capital would be politically devastating even if victorious, attempted to offer tribute to keep the strangers away. When this failed, he orchestrated an elaborate diplomatic reception in Tenochtitlan, treating Cortes as a fellow monarch. Meanwhile, Cortes formed a crucial alliance with the Tlaxcalans, who had long resisted Mexica dominance and saw an opportunity to overthrow their enemies. The situation deteriorated when Cortes took the unprecedented step of taking Moctezuma hostage. When Pedro de Alvarado, left in charge while Cortes dealt with a rival Spanish expedition, ordered a massacre of dancers and celebrants in the temple courtyard, the Mexica responded by besieging the Spanish quarters. Moctezuma, fearing confrontation near his people, urging peace to save the poor old men and women, the common people, the infants who toddle and crawl, fulfilling what Nahuas considered a ruler's paramount duty to preserve his people's future. The young warriors rejected Moctezuma's plea for peace. Under the leadership of his militant half-brother Cuitlahuac, they sent a clear message to Cortes. They were all determined to perish or have done with us. If 25,000 of them died for every one of us, they would finish with us first, for they were many and we were but few. The Spaniards attempted to escape at night, but were discovered, leading to the disastrous Noche Triste, where approximately two-thirds of the Spaniards died. While the Mexica celebrated this victory, smallpox, brought by one of the Spanish ships, struck with devastating effect. The disease had arrived on one of Narvaez's ships, perhaps in a scab in a blanket or carried by an infected man. The Europeans, mostly having previous exposure, were effectively inoculated, but the indigenous populations had no defenses. When smallpox reached a new Altepetl, death rates surged for about 60 days, taking as many as a third of the people before receding. In Tenochtitlan, Cuitlahuac, Moctezuma's younger brother and the new Tlatoani, died after only 80 days of rule. With every family devastated by smallpox, they couldn't properly mourn their ruler as religion demanded. Cuauhtehac, from the lineage descended from Itzcoatl and son of former king Ahuitzoatl, emerged as the new Tlatoani. Understanding that many surrounding peoples were considering allying with the strangers, he responded with brutal force, executing potential rivals and marrying Tecuichpotzin, Moctezuma's daughter, to legitimize his rule. Meanwhile, the Spaniards rebuilt their forces with reinforcements from Cuba and gained crucial indigenous allies, including Ixtilxochitl of Texcoco. They constructed brigantines that gave them control of Lake Texcoco and independence from the causeways. When they finally attacked Tenochtitlan, they moved with shocking speed, using cannon to demolish walls and buildings, having indigenous allies fill canals with rubble while crossbows provided cover, then controlling open spaces with horses and lances. The siege lasted 3 months, far longer than the Spaniards expected. When Cuauhtemoc finally surrendered, he went to the Spaniards by canoe with his advisors and wife Tecuichpotzin, asking only that his people be allowed to seek food in the countryside. As word spread that people could leave, survivors fled along broken causeways or swam across the lake. In the aftermath, the Spaniards established their camp in Coyoacan while Tenochtitlan lay in ruins. They ruled through indigenous elites, including the captured Cuauhtemoc, who was tortured for information about gold stores. By 1524, the Spaniards relocated their operations to the renamed City of Mexico while distributing surrounding rural areas as encomiendas to Cortés's followers. Despite this catastrophic defeat, indigenous communities demonstrated remarkable resilience. Figures like Malinzin, Cortés's translator and strategic advisor, and Tecuichpotzin, Isabel, Moctezuma's daughter, navigated their changed circumstances with pragmatism. Indigenous leaders like Chimalpopoca, Alonso de Castaneda, of Cuatinchan, used Spanish legal systems to protect their people's interests, while indigenous students at Franciscan schools learned to read and write in both Nahuatl and Spanish, using their literacy to preserve their cultural heritage. By the early 1600s, Mexico City had transformed into one of the world's wealthiest metropolises, with profound demographic and social changes. The indigenous population had plummeted due to epidemics and economic hardship, while the African slave trade had brought thousands of enslaved people to work in the city's booming industries. This created a complex social fabric where indigenous people increasingly interacted with African laborers more than with the Spanish elite. In this transformed world, indigenous historians like Domingo Chimalpahin worked tirelessly to preserve their people's history. Born in 1579 in Amaquemecan within the greater Altepetl of Chalco, Chimalpahin grew up steeped in his people's history. His family traced their noble lineage back 9 generations to the 1200s. By age 11, he was sent to Mexico City for education, and by 16, he was made mayoral, general manager of the indigenous congregation at San Antonio Abad. Despite finding satisfaction in his life, Chimalpahin experienced a profound sense of nostalgia and cultural loss. In 1608, amid calamities including floods and epidemics, he embarked on writing his people's history on a grand scale. He meticulously documented his sources, obtaining valuable manuscripts from indigenous nobility. In 1609, he sought out the elderly Hernando de Alvarado Tezazomoc, who possessed extensive Mexica genealogies and historical records. Despite their ancestors having been enemies, the two scholars found common purpose in preserving their vanishing cultural heritage. Both men expressed their commitment using traditional metaphors. "It will never be forgotten," Chimalpahin wrote, We will preserve it. We who are the younger brothers, the children, grandchildren, we who are the descendants. Their shared mission reflected the Naha worldview that maintained records of successive worlds, believing they lived under the fifth sun, with each previous era remembered through oral histories guided by writings. Today, over 1 million Mexicans speak Nahuatl, with scholars creating Nahuatl-Nahuatl dictionaries and artists publishing works in their native language. Some speak of life under a sixth sun. Through the meticulous work of indigenous historians like Chimal Pahin and modern scholars like Townsend, who listen carefully to these preserved voices, we can finally understand the Aztecs as they understood themselves, not as bloodthirsty savages or passive victims, but as complex human beings navigating a dangerous world with courage, intelligence, and remarkable resilience.